Welcome to the ABOP podcast. ABOP is the Alliance of Black Orchestral Percussionists, a nonprofit organization that focuses on mentoring future generations of Black percussionists. My name is Raynor Carroll. I am an ABOP founder. Thank you for joining us. This is the second of two podcasts that feature our ABOP founders, Tim Adams, former principal timpanist, Pittsburgh Symphony, Douglas Cardwell, former principal timpanist, New Mexico Philharmonic, Michael Crusoe, former principal timpanist, Seattle Symphony, Josh Jones, former principal percussionist, Kansas City Philharmonic, Professor Johnny Lee Lane, former director of percussion studies, Eastern Illinois University, and me, Raynor Carroll, former principal percussionist, Los Angeles Philharmonic. This roundtable discussion continues the theme from our first Founders podcast, our respective journeys, how they differed and how they were the same. A bit of background. As ABOP founders, this discussion was critical in forming a foundation for our mentorship program. Our journeys were not all the same, but it was important for us to identify certain positive and negative elements that were consistent in our individual journeys. We incorporate much of the same guidance and support that we received, along with vital elements that we perhaps lacked, into mentoring new generations of Black percussionists, ABOP protégés. Gentlemen, it is great to have you all here. Let's begin with this question. What characteristics do you see in yourself that have been vital to pursuing your goal?
Unwavering determination. And curiosity, for that matter.
Staying positive no matter what.
Organization and being creative. Just inquisitive. Just why? How?
For me, it's focus, almost to the point of obsession, but also my passion. It's just, you can't separate me from my passion. Discipline, to have the discipline, and like Douglas said, the organizational skills.
I think for me, I was never afraid of the work that was required. And I'm a good listener, and I don't question. When it came to my instruction, I never, ever questioned any teacher, ever. I trusted them, and if they said, do this, I did exactly what they said for, I don't know, since out from the time I was 7 until I was 25. I listened, and I did exactly what they said, and then I just practiced. I didn't have a problem. I liked to practice.
A good follow-up to that is, what were the important things that you did that others did not do?
I didn't question my teachers. In college, my peers would always have a bunch of questions that sort of challenged and wanted to kind of show our teachers what they knew. And my thought was, you don't have a job. You're paying for the ticket. So I don't understand why you're even talking. So in graduate school, I didn't speak to Rich Weiner until my second year. Literally, one day he said, you understand? Oh, yes. Any questions? Nope. And then one day I had a question. He went, whoa, he has a question. For about a year and a half, I said nothing in my lesson with Rich Weiner. Saw what he did. He did on the stage what he asked me to do. Why do I need to talk to him? There's nothing to say. So I think that's a certain kind of wiring. But I saw my classmates always talking and asking questions. Well, Mr. Weiner, I think, like, man, you can't play. So I don't understand why you were talking. I was blessed that my teachers were good. No, and I love them. I love them as people.
Absolutely.
I just love them.
Yeah.
So that helps a lot. Just a real affection for them.
I'd say the same for mine, Mitchell Peters. And one thing he taught me as a timpanist is, you got to study your scores. So that's one thing that I saw myself doing that my colleagues in school were not doing, for whatever reason. But I got scores, whether they were from the library or I even started buying scores. I'll never forget, before I started studying with Mitch, I was in high school. My first score that I bought was The Rite of Spring. I opened up that score and I was like, damn, how do you play? I mean, because my knowledge of the piece was what I heard, and I could tell it was different, but I didn't know how this was notated. So one of the things, like I said, that I just got stuck on scores. It's like, there's one thing to listen to a piece, but another thing to see how the timpani or percussion part fits in or doesn't fit in with what's going on in the orchestra. And that I learned from Mitch. Mitch had an extensive score library.
in rehearsals in the Philharmonic, anybody in the orchestra, particularly the brass or the horn section, if they had a question, they'd turn around to Mitch. Mitch, can I borrow that score? And he'd pass the score because he always had a score there with him every rehearsal.
That was the same for me in 15 years in Pittsburgh. I always had a score. They would do this, Timmy.
Right, right.
They just put the hand back and I'd plop it in there.
Yeah.
Something I did was try to always make a connection with whatever I was playing, whether it be physical, emotional, or analytical. And I find, or at least I found, especially at a younger age, that if I was able to find a connection with the music, it made it easier for me to play it in a way that would make a connection with the audience. And so I feel like a lot of times when I do go to work, not everybody takes that ownership of what they play. It's just like, oh, we're playing Shosty 5 this week. And I feel like Shostakovich's music is very poignant these days in many different ways. So why not play it with that knowledge of, hey, we can make a statement and maybe work through some of these issues. And maybe that helps the audience work through some of these issues as well. So I feel like I always tried to make that connection and put myself in a transparent space in a way.
So Josh, can you be a little bit more specific with how you do that with Shostakovich 5?
Without going nuts, let's see. I don't know. It's like, I always had an issue getting the same amount of information that others would get from reading scores. Like whenever I see a score, I don't see the music like I hear it. Like I see, oh, there's an oboe there, but it sounds a specific way. Or I don't know. I just get kind of, I don't know. It's just weird. So I always try to figure out what the mood is and how to best present that mood in my playing. And so I'm usually thinking, oh, what's the overall sound of the orchestra? How do I support that sound? Am I leading? Am I comping? I don't know. I just kind of ask questions about like, what makes it, where does it sit in me? Where does it do to me emotionally? And how does that affect how I approach it? And always, whenever I let that kind of thought process happen, it always ends up sounding the way it's supposed to. And it's always interesting to help students find their connection, whether it be a physical connection or an audible connection, and see how that influences what they do.
Yeah.
That's what I hear in your playing, Josh.
Yeah.
That, all that.
Sorry, that's what I mean. No, one thing I would say, it makes me think about Shostakovich 10, that snare drum part. For me, it's very easy, I think, to be creative with that. As in the first movement, I hear war, I hear hell, I hear whatever you want to call it with that part. And it says tambour militaire. And I think, you know, this is where I get creative. In the first movement, I pull out a field drum for that. Rum da 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 dum. I don't hear a nice 5.5 or a 4 or even an 8. I hear a field drum there. It has to be that strong, that powerful. Whereas in the scherzo, you know, I'd use, you know, a less deep drum, whether it's a 5.5, 6, whatever, because it needs to speak fast. And there are those delicate moments. We have the pianissimo 4-stroke roughs. I'd use a piccolo on that. So, you know, I'm up to 3 drums, but I don't care. This is what the music calls for. I only use that field drum in the first movement, but it's worth it for me. I think Shostakovich would have liked it. I'd love to have 5 players back there playing that all at once. It's like, whoa, that's what we want, you know? Yeah, that's how I interpret things like that, you know? It's just, I hear it and I just have to do it.
You know, your comment, and Josh, it reminds me of a time Bill Kraft and I were having lunch, and he said something that was really profound to me because I never thought of it that way, although I approached it that way. He said, it's not important enough to know your part. You need to know how it fits in. And so once you realize that, then that's where the inspiration comes from, like what you were just talking about. You know, you're up to 3 snare drums. I mean, you know, you hear it in the music. You know, you relate to what's going on, and then that's what inspires those ideas that you I think, and that you and Josh were describing. For me, I did scores by default. When I was a student, you know, I didn't have easy access to drums, so I just studied the music. Then when I got behind the drums, it all came together. You know, the rest was kind of technical, and I started out a very technical-oriented player, you know, being in drum corps, you know. And like what you just described about having that many drums behind you, well, see, to me, that's drum corps. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, and people, some musicians, they used to comment about ensemble playing and the rhythmic accuracy in a way that enhanced the art. I mean, you know, I thought rhythm God was a bit much. You know, people's temperance okay, but rhythm God, I don't think I was. But that, for me, that came from my drum corps experience, you know, because you got a drum line, you got eight, you know, you got four snares and four tenors, and we all need to be played together, and it's being judged, you know what I mean, that precision type playing. So, but anyway, back to my point, I hear what you guys are saying, and it just reminded me of that conversation with Kraft about the importance of knowing how your part fits in. And then from there, you get moved, you get inspired by the music, you know, and the direction that it takes you.
In terms of feeling, I was very fortunate because my teachers taught me how to play in the orchestra. They told me exactly what to do to play. Yeah, I remember my second month in New York in CIM, it was a Beethoven symphony, you know, when I was playing, and Mr. Duff stopped and asked me what the second oval was playing. And, you know, and I made something up, and then he said, oh, so you don't know this. And then that was it. So that was like 30 minutes gone. And so that never happened again. And then the next time he said, what's going on here, Tim? And I just started singing everything. He just started laughing. But it really changed my life in terms of how I approached the instrument. And when I said to Mr. Wiener, that was 3 years of percussion. He would say things like, you know, now this Glock part in Don Juan, that's why I always play next to the wind section, but you go and you talk to the flutist and you tell them, now right here, I'm going to listen to you, which is reverse psychology. You want them to listen to you. You know, so he used to tell me those kind of things all the time. Okay, go and talk to this person and tell them this. And he created collaboration by default, because a lot of time people in the orchestra, they don't listen to us. They never have. They, you know, they just don't, even the best of them. And so he taught me how to engage with my colleagues with them not knowing I'm engaging with them. And so that really, those 3 years of just timpani and 3 years of just percussion, you know, really informed my relationship to the ensemble. And I always found it as a relationship, not as me, the conductor in the rear. I had a relationship to the music. It was my responsibility to understand how I fit and to not be belligerent about it and not be ego-driven about it. And then to have a collaborative feeling, and then everybody would want to play with you, because you don't have to, when you're not ego-driven, people want to play with you because they feel like you're really listening and trying to support them and asking them what they need. And it makes it such a beautiful experience when you treat it that way. You know, when you have a job, even before you get a job, it makes the process, like Josh was talking about, you actually love being in school because it's such a great sense of discovery.
Boy, Richard's sensitivity was off the charts. The last time we played together at Teton, he sat up right next to me and he was playing a tam-tam, and I had never heard that instrument played that way before. I mean, it was, there were times during rehearsal, I actually lost track of where I was listening to him. I mean, it was just incredible. It really was.
At his funeral, people would tell, people in the orchestra said that the way Rich played the triangle, they would say that. They would say, I would stop playing to turn around, like, what was that? He'd go, ding. And I didn't, the rabbi said, he said, Rich, why do you love it so much? And he says, every percussion instrument has a soul. It's my job to bring it out. I never knew that in all those years. And I thought, this is changing my life, laying up there. I just feel like this music is so transformative in every way. And in terms of a young Black person, kid wanting to play this music, our story is in this music. My story is in Strauss. My story is in Beethoven. My story is in Shostakovich. My story is in Bach. My story is in Ditchieu. In my, you know, my story is there.
And then to wrap it up, we have to care. It's about caring enough to do that. And I think that's a message we want to transcend.
Absolutely. So what were some of the obstacles that you faced and how did you overcome them? I can start off and say when I was a student, obstacle was instruments.
Yeah, that's
an obvious one. And how I overcame is, you know, I pooled together with my buddies. A friend of mine had a van, so, you know, I'd get timpani and borrow his van and go do my gig, come back, you know, unload and take the van to the gas station, fill it up and take it back to his place, and he was happy. But, you know, I did whatever I had to do to get my hands on the instruments, whether it was staying at school over the weekend or staying late at night. You know, you just do. And again, I didn't think second about it. This is what I had to do. So I just automatically did it.
My obstacle as a professor and conductor early in my career was space, places for the kids to practice rooms. At Eastern Illinois, I went from no practice rooms to 12. And because I made a case for it, I say, flute player can go on a tree and practice.
Right.
A trumpet player can go in the hallway and go in any room and practice. I say, a percussionist can't go in different rooms. You go run them out.
Right.
You can't practice in the hallway. You can't go in the classroom because I'm about to go throw you out for the next class. And so they finally agreed. Hey, they had a meeting. I was surprised to see the title of the meeting. The chairman said, make room for percussion. And it shocked me that we're going to have a faculty meeting on make room for percussion.
Wow.
And they made room. They understood what I was talking about. And they saw the impact of being able, those kids being able to go into, have a key. Every student had a key, can go in and practice in those areas and not interfere with other people in the music building anywhere else, you know. So my obstacle was living that dream. Hey, I need space.
Yeah.
This is the reason why I need the space.
Right.
And you can tell the difference when you come to my percussion ensemble concerts and
right.
stuff that, hey, it yeah. really pays off.
Yeah.
Percussion ensemble is the reason why the orchestra sounded better.
Absolutely.
The wind ensemble. The Absolutely. Symphonic band.
Yep.
The chamber groups.
When they needed
the percussionists, man. The
yeah.
kids were so prepared because that one on the part meant so much in all those ensembles. Those kids knew how to handle those situations.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, what I say to that is I resent the fact that we have to lift percussion up to the level of the other instruments. Why should not we have dedicated space? They do. Are we not musicians? I mean, I remember—
piano players got tons of pianos.
Oh yeah.
In the practice
oh, yeah.
room.
I remember an instance at an institution, which I will not name, but a student came to me and said they were practicing in the percussion room, and one of the faculty members came over and told them to stop because they were next door and they couldn't hear what they're doing. How do you answer that? I mean, wow. I mean, this is what I've always said. This is what I've always thought. We do not get the respect. But I will always fight for it because we deserve it, you know?
Right.
And I remember former music director Andre Previn said to me, some of the percussionists I've met have been the best musicians I've ever worked with. Right. And, you know, he's telling me we deserve that, you know? It's our time because it's the truth, you know?
Again, what we want to pass along to the proteges and our lineage is that care. And one of my obstacles was the same thing about when I got the job here in New Mexico. I mean, I won't even tell you the instruments I played on for three seasons. I mean, I was so distraught in playing them. I mean, the principal percussionist says, I don't even know how you get the sound you get out of it. But I made an argument and I had to go to the board. And just like Prof said, you make an argument for something, but if you can make it people relate to, it's the same as, because they don't understand percussion, number one. So you have to educate them about it's a single voice, number one. There's no other voice, I'm talking about no other voice like this in the orchestra. And this enhances the quality of this professional orchestra. And the board literally raised 20, 25 grand, and we bought a new set of Walter lights. I mean, but if you sit back there and don't educate, one, I think we all have the care for it, but we have to educate. And that's the reason why people don't understand. They don't know. It's no excuse. It's just ignorance. And all you do is educate them with an argument that they can relate to. And like Prof said, I was surprised too. You go into this meeting and they're handing over this. The next thing you know, I'm picking up drums in the next 6 to 8 months. But stemming from that, they asked me to play a concerto later on, and that was with a different set of drums. But the thing is, you make the argument of why it's important and how it relates, how they can relate to it with education. That's what I believe.
And I never gave up in trying to make things right. I mean, all the way, this August, I celebrate 50 years when I got my first college job.
Congrats.
And so 1972. And so I fought every battle all the way to the end of those 33 years of teaching. I got the things that I needed and wanted. And people believed in me eventually that what I was doing was so positive and so much for the department and not just for me.
Right.
It made the department better.
That's the
thing. I did the United States Percussion Camp. That was just not me, but that was the university and the whole school and the music department. It represented the whole state of Illinois and much beyond. You got kids from 40 states.
Entry.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Life is not a dress rehearsal.
You know, the obstacle thing, and it doesn't matter what organization you're in, percussion and timpani typically gets no respect. Mr. Duff said he got in the orchestra, so he's been there 2 years, and somebody put their violin on his drum.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then
famous stories.
Yeah. So, so what he did, he went to the pawn shop and found a violin, and he did it again, and he moved it, and then he took the and he went, bam. And the guy was like, And then he says, next time, don't put your violin on my timpani.
Yeah.
You know, and there's, I have stories like that every orchestra. My last one, I wanted to buy another set of drums. That I came in, I bought 5 drums. And I said, I was playing calf. I said, you don't want to buy them? I took those calf heads off. I said, I won't put them on again until you get another set of drums. Then in like a month and a half, they found a donor. It's interesting how they worked. So it doesn't matter where you are.
Right.
You're
right. I mean, I can tell you when I joined the Phil in 83, there was no budget for percussion. In there was no money earmarked for instruments, for repair, for maintenance, for heads. I couldn't believe it. And, to make a long story short, I made it happen because we deserve it. They were not going to do it. I mean, I'd have to go to them to get an okay to buy a triangle. I'm like, are you kidding me? At that time, a $75 triangle, you have to okay me? But that's the way it was,
It's like Johnny said, you have a standard, and then you fight for the standard.
And our standard should be no different from any other instrumentalist in the ensemble.
That's right.
I can take this to another level where, they come to me. It's not often, but once in a while, do we need this extra player? I'm like, do you want a third clarinet? Do we need a fourth trumpet? It's in the score. I will say the opposite. The Philharmonic was very good with that, but there were a few times, it's to me, it's disrespectful to who we are as musicians and what we do.
Seattle Symphony, they had one set of old German ringer timpani. I think they had bought back from Vic Firth years ago. They weren't very well maintained. But what I put, there were some leftover calf heads, and I put those on to make them sound decent. The alternative was a pair of Ludwig balance pedal timpani with the mechanism inside, and then the outside drums were the crank, the Ludwig timpani. And I'm looking at this, and I thought, this is a threat to getting tenure, right? Because all people, you know what I mean? All they know is what they hear. And so, you know, I went to management then. I said, we need Tiffany. And this one, she was new. She was trying to make an impression. She was the new general manager. And then she said, well, we got Tiffany. What do you need more Tiffany for? And I thought, so I called a meeting with Midale, then music director, and the management staff. I mean, everybody that I could get hold of. And I sat there and I put all the drums on stage and I went through and I played them. And the look on their faces were, I mean, it was like, you know, now they're here, they're up close and they're hearing the difference and they're hearing, you know, what it is that I'm pointing out. And at one point with the Ludwig Timpani, I turned to Midale, who was in my corner. I mean, he was kind of laughing at the whole thing because he realized what it was that I was, and who knows, maybe the guy before me tried it. I don't know. But I asked him, how would you feel if the principal trumpet player pulled out a bugle on Mahler 5 and played the solo on it? And Reiner, you know, he's laughing, but everybody else, you know, they're sitting there and they're kind of looking at each other. And, that would be pretty bad, wouldn't it? And then I said, this is what I go through. This is what I'm dealing with. And we need to fix this, you know? And I even pointed out when San Francisco Symphony came through town, and I just told him, I said, I got together with my friend Barry Jacowski, who was then at the time. And I showed him this, and Barry was upset, and I was embarrassed. I said, I had, you know, to show my peers what it is that I have to play on, and we're supposed to be a major symphony orchestra. I said, this is ridiculous. So I finally got the ball rolling where they started having, at least I got a budget for getting calf heads, and they start paying me for maintenance work. But I was still not getting that second set of timpani that we needed. And then finally, the conductor actually tapped a donor who gave me a very easy payment loan to buy another set of Ringer timpani. And Harvey Vogel, who was percussion at Longstar Percussion, yeah, he worked it out so that I was able to set up. There was a plan that was really set up for institutions where you could do a rental purchase of instruments. And he set that up so that I could make these easy payments over a period of time. And thanks to this donor who reached in his pocket, I mean, there were no limitations, no restrictions, anything. He just said, pay me, you know, how do you want to pay me back? You set it up, you know, at the terms and everything. And it worked out great. But that's just another example of the mindset that we have to deal with, you know, that you guys are describing. And then, of course, when Jerry Schwartz came on, then I started getting more calf heads. I mean, they just start rolling it. And I made it a point to stockpile calf.
Yeah.
Because I knew one day management was going to say, we can no longer afford it. You know, and when that day came, I went, okay, no problem, you know. But by then, the Renaissance heads had come in on the market, which really helped a lot. I mean, I had the guys in the trumpet section saying, you know, hey, that doesn't sound like plastic, you know, and I said, well, yeah, it is. So I started switching up. For subscriptions, I had the calf, you know, and for the pops, you know, I call them the throwaway gigs and the family concerts. I had the Renaissance, you know, and one trumpet player, he described it interesting. He said, it doesn't sound like plastic. He says, it sounds like your calf heads only without that much depth. They sound brighter than what the calf. This is a trumpet player,
right?
Telling me this. So, yeah. You know, the quality improved. I started getting a budget for heads. When I came and played with you at the Hollywood Bowl, when we did Mahler 2 together.
Yeah.
And I went back there and I saw all those heads that Mitch had. I thought, yeah, that's the ticket. And that's how I started stockpiling heads. You know,
yeah.
I saw what Mitch, he had a case.
Oh yeah.
A drum head case,
right,
with stacks of heads in there.
Right.
And I thought, this is how it's done.
Yeah.
This is what I need to do, because like I said, I knew that day was going to come. They were going to start crying about money. Well, you know, yeah. I don't know if we could continue to, but by then, you know, I had the store.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I always say, you know, they'll tell you there is no money, but there's always money. There is the money for it. They might not want to put it to percussion, but there is money there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I had Schwartz in my corner, and he could pick some pockets, you know. With
Yeah.
But then when his status started waning, that's when they started whining about
budget,
you know, and cutting back, you know, and the contract negotiations and all that. But by then, I was ahead of the game, thanks to Mitch.
Well, Mitch was, you know, he had to he had to have a backup for the backup. So
yeah, I remember you told me that.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
But I was like, hey, you know,
I reaped the benefit of that stockpile because when we went on tour, and we were the first visiting orchestra to play in Benaroya. You know, Mike and those guys, it was their hall, and it was their first year. And we're back, and Mike had a beautiful room where he tucked his, and all the drums were like immaculate.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, man, here you go. I went, what's that? He said, you can have, he gave me four calf heads. I'm like, are you sure? He goes, yeah, man, enjoy yourself. I'm like, oh, okay. So I know he had a stockpile. Gave me four. And they were beautiful heads. I mean, spectacular.
I still those Irish calf heads I had. Yeah.
They were great. Okay, that's it. That's my story.
So, guys, how do you maintain your focus? What keeps you going? Before you got your position, how were you able to maintain the focus with all that you have to do? Whether it's just the music or jobs you have on the side that are outside of music, how did you maintain juggling and prioritizing? Were you able to prioritize?
To the detriment of me, my prioritization in college, grad school, post-college, music was number one. I mean, I dated the same girl in school, but I got a letter that said, you know, I'm tired of being number two. I mean, this is our senior year. We dated for 4 years. It was right, but literally, that was my priority. That was my sole priority. Now, I dated a little bit in graduate school, but I mean, you just barely dated. I dated drums, and literally, that was my first priority. And it was up until a long time. I mean, you know, I wasn't married, so that was my thing. And that was always the go-to. That was the when you were feeling bad, that was the go-to. When you're feeling good, that was my go-to. And it always gave back. It just always gave back. So it was just that love for me. And that was my priority. I know that's different for other people. And I said, I don't know how y'all did it. So I want to hear. But that was it for me.
You know, for me, when I went to school, motivation wasn't difficult because all I had to do is set my foot in Severance Hall. It was literally for me that simple. I just go there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night, and then I go back and practice. It was extremely easy. When I go, I hit the drum, I don't sound like them. Let me just keep going. So I always say I realized I was very, very fortunate because not only was I, my teachers were very serious about their job. They're very serious. I mean, they practiced and their priority was their family and their job. They didn't write books. They didn't make sticks. It was real clear for me. I watched them. It was their family, their job, then us. And you felt important to them. They cared about you. And so staying motivated was very simple. I hit that standard. I'm like, oh, doesn't sound like Rich Meter. Okay, that doesn't sound like Chloe Duff. And then when Paul got there, it didn't change. So for me, it was very easy. I just would go to Hines, to Severance Hall. And that was like my North Star.
Right, yeah.
Like, there it is. But for me, Rainer, to answer it, that priority for me was Severance Hall.
You know, the thing that motivated and kept me going was that playing drums, it actually, for me, from a peer perspective, it became like a source of identity. You know, I became, I walked down the hall and said, hey, there's that drummer. You know, even if they didn't know my name, they said the drummer. Said, oh, yeah, there's the guy that plays in the band. You know, people would notice like doing art assemblies in high school and so forth. And also I would get calls from local groups to play, you know, because of it. I remember this, we had what's called in high school, a senior spectacular. That's where the seniors have the big to do, you know, the big show and stuff. And there was this one band called Sore Thumb and the 12 Fingers, and they needed a drummer. And like, guess who got the call, you know? So for me, it just became an identity thing. And that made me, that gave me a sense of self-worth, I guess. You know, again, I'm talking in terms of peer relationships. I was very athletic, but I had asthma, so I couldn't play football like I wanted to, you know. So the fallback was music, and that actually got me noticed the way that some of the high school athletes were, you know. And that, so that kind of what helped keep me going, you know, in terms of sticking with it. That along with the fact that I just had patience when it came to success, you know. I failure was just something that I just couldn't handle, but it motivated me. If I fell short about something, then that just made me try that much harder. And that's what the patience, I think, kicked in. So that's what it was for me to keep me going, became a self-identity.
You know, Mike, since you went on back to high school, I mean, that's one of the reasons I probably never got beat up, because I played the drums.
Yeah.
You can. Drums too. It's like, don't mess with TK. He's right. He's good. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
And it's the same. I mean, the drums, it helps you be accepted because you bring people joy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I know for a fact, though, I didn't get beat up. I know that.
And, you know, when you said help, it helped with acceptance. I mean, and it was in a way that, you know, I mentioned like the high school athlete, the high school jock. Well, they're popular, but then what often came along with that was some degree of some sense of jealousy or rivalry, you know. I didn't experience that in music, you know. I mean, band, you know, you were just weren't a threat to anybody, you know. You were just somebody that they admired, you know. So, yeah, I didn't get beat up either.
Speaking of high school days, so how was it for you guys? Did you guys excel in high school? Were you like the drum section leader? Did you stand out in high school? Let's start with the professor. Did you know you were going to teach? Did you know you were going to be a leader when you're in high school, Johnny?
Yes. I knew after the summer of 1965 what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a college professor. I knew I wanted to do whatever, and I wanted to play all the instruments. And because of my experience at the University of Kansas when I was 15 years old, I was already playing pretty good by the time I got to ninth grade. But the 10th grade year was the true foundation of what my career was going to be. I knew I was going to be a college professor, and I knew I was going to do a percussion camp that where every kid can participate and not just sit and watch and take notes. It was going to be all hands-on. I knew I was going to develop this percussion program. This is what I'm dreaming about when I'm 15.
Right.
So all I did through my whole going to college and getting degrees and all that was just follow my dream.
Yeah.
And to this day, that's exactly what I'm doing even now.
When you were in high school, were you doing some teaching at that point?
Yes.
Okay.
Because by the time I got to 11th grade, I was teaching at Melanie Music. This was during segregation. So the only time the white kids would see me was at the music store. And I taught percussion. And so that's the only time they would see me. They would read about me in the newspaper. This black kid that was going all over and doing all this stuff. And that he was teaching at Melanie Music in Vero Beach, Florida.
So Johnny, what was it about teaching that you got that connection, that got that spark?
The teaching started by the time I got to eighth grade.
Uh-huh.
When I started teaching the kids behind me.
Right.
They just flocked at my house, man, on weekends and whatever. Show me. What books did we get? I mean, everybody was, that was the beginning of teaching. By the time I got to 10th grade, I knew I wanted to be a college professor, teacher. And I knew I had to develop all the stuff to make me successful. And I knew I had to put in the time and all that practicing and all that kind of stuff. Man, when I was at Southern University, which is HBCU, I was practicing at least on weekends, 10 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I was the only one with a key to the building. I got up every morning at 4 o'clock.
Wow.
And I practiced from 4 to 7 every morning, showered, and made my 8 o'clock class.
Wow.
This was all 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
People thought I was crazy. I said, no, I'm practicing to be what I'm going to be.
Right. For your life. That's right.
My life. Yeah. This is my life. This is going to be my life.
Right.
And so I wore a suit and tie. I wore a shirt and tie. I had the briefcases. This is before stick bags. There was no such thing as a stick bag. You had briefcases. Inside the briefcase, you had your mouse, your books, your tuning forks, your dictionary of musical terms.
Right.
You had everything in that briefcase.
Yeah.
And your solo pieces and whatever, you know. And I was telling Tim, this is how I met Jim Atwood. Jim Atwood was the same age. He was at LSU. They did not have a percussion teacher. A clarinet teacher taught percussion at LSU. And those guys would come over, the white guys would come over to Southern, and we'd be in the parking lot talking about our dreams. I remember Atwood was showing me timpani mallets that he was making. Man, Johnny, I'm making these timpani mallets. Check these out. I'm going, he's 18.
Right.
And I'm 18.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, I knew by the time I got 15 years old, 10th grade, that I was going to be the teacher.
I want to say something about that, about Johnny. I've been teaching for 35 years. And Johnny sent me two of his students for graduate school. And those only two that I've ever had in 35 years that were the most well-rounded I've ever taught in my life. I mean, snare drum, xylophone, marimba, all the toys, congas, bongos, djembe, pandero, drum set. I mean, they don't play at them. They can play them. And so to me, that's the testament of a person having a goal young and doing it until they got the job and then refining that their entire career. Because I taught the United States, I met Johnny in Indianapolis Drum Center, and this guy came in, he was clean and you know, he had a suit on and he had this flyer, United States Percussion Camp. Hey man, I'm Johnny. And I said, man, nice to meet you. So I looked at him, Johnny, okay, cool. I didn't think anything of it. I kept seeing him. And then one day he says, man, I want you to come and teach at my camp. I'm like, okay. And so we worked it out. And I drove my van over there. And when I showed up, it was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And I mean weird, because it was like a mini NAMM show. It was semis, literally semis and drums everywhere. Like 50 drum sets, 25, I mean, just drums everywhere. And I thought, how did this man get all of this gear here? And then the students started showing up, and it was hundreds of them, and everybody in Duke Chancellor, Lewis Nash, and everybody who was anybody in drums was teaching there.
Wow.
And then he sold all of that gear. I mean, people talk about that. I'm like, whatever, man. I couldn't believe it until I saw it. And for anybody watching this, that's a testament of not only having a vision, but having a vision that has true clarity to it. It was refined at 18. No. At 14, 13. So when you get something that's 13 until you're 21, and then until you're older, and it's the same thing, I still learn from that idea. I mean, he's a living testament of that. I'm not even trying to make it feel good. I actually saw it in real time. So it can actually be done. It's incredible. And I've told Johnny this before. It's remarkable. So I just wanted to say that. I mean, I experienced his work. That's all.
So, Johnny, let me ask you, what are your successful habits? What do you see that you did over the years that you repeated that got you there and sustained you? What are some habits that were important?
I followed my vision. I just saw it. It was in front of me.
Yeah.
And I knew what to say, when to say it. I was a very quiet person when it came to faculty meetings, which is the worst thing in my career that I hated, was music faculty meetings.
Right.
So I would sit there and say nothing.
Yeah.
And then finally somebody would say, well, professor, what do you think about it? See, if they hadn't asked me the question, I wouldn't have said nothing.
Right.
But unless it pertained to percussion.
Right.
All right. But then they asked me a question, I'd tell them the truth. And I never, ever made up something that I didn't believe. So if somebody asked me a question,
and
they want the real answer from me.
Yeah, not just what they want to hear. Yeah.
Right.
I gave them what I wanted. I was the best recruiter. I had no scholarships for percussion, but the kids were coming from all over the country to study with me. How did I do that? It's because my soul and my attitude and my vision and the products that I had put out there, who became college professors, teachers, performers, and educators. So I just stayed with the plan. And to this day, I'm still staying with the plan. And because I have other things that I want to do, I still practice. but I'm playing stuff that I want to play.
Right.
So I don't I don't have this thing where I got to do this and I got to do that.
Yeah.
I go to my five Optimarima right here, I go there for a reason. When I go to my five company over there, I go there for a reason. I got pieces I want to play. I want to play some of the Carter pieces. I want to play the some of the pieces that were written for me. I want to play out of the Hulk Grounder books, you know, book one and two. You know, I love the Goodman book. I love the one muffling exercise that you can play 1,000 ways. When I go to the drum set, I all the stuff, I studied with Alan Dawson. Alan Dawson taught me in the world. He taught me more than drum set. When Alan Dawson would teach, he would teach. And he taught me things that you just can't learn from the average, say, drum set teacher. But Alan Dawson was more than drum set. See, he was one of the best vibraphone players you ever heard. Most people don't know that, but in later years, he was just gigging on vibe. He was another Milt Jackson.
Hmm.
He knew all the tunes.
Hmm.
While you're on drum set, he's on vibes. And you better know where you are. And he always said, Johnny, I'm going to have lunch. Would you like to have lunch with me? I said, yes. He said, we're going to have soup and sandwich. Every time I would see Alan Dawson, I'll say, soup
and sandwich. That's great. So, Josh, tell us about some successful habits that you have.
Oh, man. Well, kind of like Tim, I just accepted the work. Like my teachers initially were always like, you have to do 100 strokes with the right hand, 200 strokes with the left hand. I was like, bet I'll do 200 with my right and however many I can get out with my left. And something else I was always, I don't know if I was just really, I just needed something to do. And so I loved doing long division for fun in math class. Like I would write a bunch of random numbers, like the longest line you could think of, and divide them by like 9 and see how long it would take me to do, like just because I was bored. And like I was always thinking about like, how can I practice in a way where I won't get bored? Like what's something else I can do? What's all the tangential? I was always looking for connections. Like what's the tangent for hitting a timpani? Oh, I've seen this stroke in taiko drumming. Let me watch taiko drummers play. Like what can I connect from that? Like, oh, taiko, what else is something that I can connect? Martial arts, let me read up on some martial arts. It's just something I always wanted to do. And I never thought of myself as being a principal percussionist. I thought I'd be a third percussionist somewhere. Like I'd have to practice that hard to get a third percussion spot somewhere. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'll just see whatever I can get at some point.
Josh, it sounds like your B-flat lessons of stick control and work on this excerpt, you were creative and you thought outside of that. What else can I do?
Yeah, sometimes to the detriment, like I was really into, like if someone said, oh, you have to practice 6 hours a day, like, okay, I will practice 10 hours a day. Somebody was like, well, while you're sleeping, somebody else is practicing. Well, I'll learn how to lucid dream so I can practice in my sleep. Like I was literally on that. I had to stop doing that because it would just happen. I would be trying to actually get sleep. But yeah, I was just trying to find any creative way to find some edge that I didn't know if I would need it or not. Like I just wanted to be more prepared than anyone else. So if anyone asked me to do anything, I could do it a million different ways.
But the creativity just came out of you. You didn't have to look elsewhere. It just, you just found ways, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. That's very good. That's unique too. It's not everybody that can do that. Give a student something to practice, they'll practice it and that's it. That's sometimes, it. You know? So yeah. That's very cool.
I feel like, especially now with my students, I have to show them that it's okay to be creative with their practice. And so I have to give them like, oh, have you ever thought about this sounding like this particular song or whatever? So I think giving students the permission to be creative, and it's not just you have to practice in this box. Like,
right.
That's not right. Where the music lies. It's like somewhere out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Inspiring.
I think it says a lot if you get a student and they practice that box. That's that means they're going to go a certain way. To me, that's my interpretation of that, is that they're going to be limited in a lot of ways, because that is not music. Music came from improvisation years ago before it was written down. And then when it was started to be written down, it was still meant to be, oh, you just, you know, roughly play this, you know, and then it got very exact. But anyway, the essence, I think, of what we do is to take it and run with it. To a certain extent, you can't do that all the time, because there's always, you know, so what do you do if the Shostakovich Age of Gold polka, do you play it straight or do you, you know, we always have those debates, but it's music, it's human, it's not played by a computer, it shouldn't sound that way. So anyway, let me throw it over to Mike now. What are some successful habits that you had, Mike?
I've always strived to maintain a positive attitude. Mm. You know, about whatever, you know, whatever it is, whatever the situation, because I found in doing it and maintaining a positive attitude, it kept you in a frame of mind of being objective, which then in turn helped you to learn to know what it is that you don't know, you know, and which in turn helped me grow as a person, I feel. So it began with, for me, it all began with just maintaining a positive attitude and being open-minded, you know, about matters. And that's, I feel like that's not only carried me through a music career, but just life in general. You know yeah. what I mean?
Mike, let me interrupt you with asking or saying that quite often with students that I have, you know, you give them something to practice and they get frustrated in that they're not able to learn it, you know, relatively soon, in a week or something. And to me, I'm relating to what you're saying about keeping a positive attitude. You have to pace your practice. You have to understand that some things are going to take a while to develop right. and learn that piece or that excerpt. But you have to have a positive attitude as you're building and you're working that up. And you're looking back a week or two ago, and I'm actually doing it faster now. And you look, you know, you keep that attitude. Is that part of what you did in learning learning music and parts and excerpts or whatever?
Right. Yeah, that's a big part of it, actually. And then, you know, where students are concerned, I think there's also something that I call the genius syndrome, meaning that I've had students who were very quick and adapt at other things. They pick it up quickly. But then when they don't do that, where their lessons are concerned, I would point out to them, I said, well, you know, you're not being patient enough with yourself. And the example that I always draw that always seemed to help was that I would point out the difference between a receptive language and expressive language, you know, as you're growing up and maturing, you know, as a kid. You know, the ability to perceive what someone's telling you is one thing, but then for you to be able to feed it back, you know, to express it, you know, is another, and there can be a gap there. And I would point out to some students, you know, that's where you're filling that gap. You know, you see what it is that I'm doing and what I'm telling you, but then your inability to feed it back, you know, in a certain time period is frustrating you, and that's causing you to, you know, a block, you know.
Right.
So I would always encourage positive attitude, being patient, you know what I mean, and that you'll grow from there. And then sometimes the practice, you know, the length of practice, you know, I would tell them, you know, like some, you might hear some students say they spent the whole hour practicing, and then some students might say, well, they just spent the half an hour, and then the half an hour student has picked up more than what the student picked up in an hour. And it's because of the approach involved, you know, the content involved. You know, if you open a book and you read a paragraph, well, if you go through the paragraph just calling out the words, by the time you get at the end of it, you don't know what you read, you know.
Right.
On the other hand, if you take your time and read the paragraph, you know, and grasp the content, then, you know, you could do that in a shorter period of time than what someone who spent their hours calling out word for word and not realizing what they did by the end of it. You know, so the analogy there was that some people, if they concentrate their practice time at a certain limit and they're consistent with it, then they're going to grow from there. And eventually, you know, that half an hour you spent every day suddenly becomes an hour, 2 hours. By the time you're done, you know, you realize that you spent all this time without knowing it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's that thing of what's the one piece of conventional advice that you disagree with the most? That is it for me. Practice, practice, practice. That's not what it should be. It's your quality. It's perfect practice that makes a difference. And that was a perfect example of what you said. One student can practice something for half an hour and gain more from someone that spent 2 hours on it because they've got their phone that's going off, because they're not, they're making, they're constantly making mistakes as they're practicing. They should stop. Wait a minute. Right. I'm doing something wrong. I'm going too fast. Let me slow it down, you know?
Yeah.
So Douglas, what do you have to offer as some of the habits that you've maintained over the years that are worthwhile?
That failure, that fall down six times, get up seven. You know, I mean, I look at how many auditions I took. I didn't win all my auditions. You know, I don't know anyone, not too many people who have. And you learn from those, man. I mean, you really grasp, I'll never ever do that again. You're not gonna win an audition from something, but you can sure counsel yourself out by doing something. And then you figure out what those things are that you do. And like the next one, I will never, ever do that again, ever. I remember one, I was playing something and it was an F sharp on the 26th. And I didn't check the range of that drum. And I was flat and it just threw it off. I will never, ever do that again. You know, never, ever. But each one that you would take, I would make a list of like the category and what it was in. It wouldn't be just that one thing, but what transcends itself to make that behavior happen. And then that behavior changes. And after the behavior changes, then that's your growth.
Absolutely. So, Tim, give us some habits that you've maintained over the years.
Not being afraid to fail. I'll basically do anything and I'm comfortable not being good at it, just in general. And I think that has helped me a tremendous amount. But yeah, that alone. I mean, because I never tried to do anything safe. And then by doing that, you know, sometimes it fails. You know, sometimes you sound terrible. It just doesn't work. It's just embarrassing. And I will still do that even now, even though I'm supposed to be whoever I am.
Yeah,
I'll still do it. I'll still fall and be like, oh, that was woof. And I think that helps with growth.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I saw all my teachers make mistakes.
Right.
I've seen them step on it. I'm like, oh, check that out. Okay.
Yeah.
I remember something that when I was in Indianapolis, one thing that Winton told me, he said, man, you have to be willing to sound sad in public to be good.
That's really good.
Yeah. And I never really let that go. I thought it was very poignant.
Yeah.
And this is, if someone's listening who's young, I mean, whatever you fail at, it's only that moment. And then it's gone. Nobody's going to really remember. They just won't remember. But they will remember if you keep trying.
Yeah, I mean, I would add on to that. And I think this is something we're saying that we have in common. For me, it's being very critical of yourself and your playing. You know, if you want to be amongst the best, you have to. You have to be critical of yourself. And you have to, you know, we all make mistakes. I'll never forget, I went up to Esa-Pekka once at a concert and came in early or late. And he said, you know, we're not machines, man. You know, it's okay. Nobody. Yeah. I mean, we've all, conductors make mistakes. They do it all the time. But anyway, that's something.
You know what?
That's something that we learn from making our mistakes, because, you know, you got to be critical. You got to try to improve and not just accept it and say, okay, you know, that's just the way it is. You know, you got to try to move it to the next level. Mike, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say what inspired me when it came to performing. This is early on in my career. Because I used to get, you know, whenever the least little thing go wrong during performance, you know, really not there. So I'm sitting there one Sunday afternoon and, you know, not working, and I'm watching gymnastics. And this girl is doing her thing on the balance beam, and she falls off. And she gets up, she goes back, and she gets back up on the balance beam, and finishing the routine, and it clicked. I thought, okay, I'm getting the message here. Here's this kid performing in front of an arena full of people, falls off the beam. Everybody knows she made a mistake. She made a mistake, and she knows everybody has seen her make the mistake. What does she do? She gets right back up on the balance beam, continues her routine, and nails it. That's what people, you know, at the end, you know, the applause. See, that's what people remember. She was persistent.
Right.
They saw the fall and the all, you know, but then she finished. Yeah. And it was, you know, and I and then that's when a little light went on. You know, it's not how you fall, it's how you get up.
Yeah.
I think that definitely applies to auditions because we've all been on both sides. It's not the worst thing to make a mistake in an audition. Once you've played a wrong note in Porgy or your rough didn't come out right in Kije, whatever, you know, it happens. And it shouldn't be, for me, if I'm listening, it shouldn't be something that dismisses somebody because we all make a mistake. And everybody on that panel has made mistakes too. So they know it too.
Oh yeah, they know.
You know, the jobs that I've won, I've stepped on something huge.
Mm-hmm.
It was so huge that a committee laughed. I can name every, and they just started laughing because it was so huge. That's just, you know. Then I tell one quick story about making a mistake. I got tons of them in my career, but one in particular, there's a Strauss. I have a really good one. It's one of those Strauss waltzes that's similar to the one in Rosenkavalier. I forgot which one. But it's big. So the short of it is, the last 30 or 40 bars, I missed the, there was a big cutoff, and then I missed the downbeat somehow.
Right.
And I was a bar off from the entire orchestra for the whole time. But in my mind, everybody's wrong but me. I'm just sticking it in there, and it's just wrong, and I just wrong. And I thought, I'm going to show them. And in my mind, everybody's wrong but me.
That's beautiful.
And so we finish, and the concert master looks at me like, and then Bob Lauver turned around and said, what are you doing? And I said, man, I couldn't stop. And he just started laughing, and I couldn't stop. I know something's wrong, but I'm right. And it's just one of those things where the next night it was fun.
Great
but
story,
I just man. Kept
I'm sorry, you just reminded me. So we were in a recording session to the symphony, and I came in like two bars early because, you know, you stop and start all the time, you know, they're going to hear. I came in two bars early, and Jerry stopped the orchestra, and he looked at me, and I said, Jerry, the orchestra's late. I can't work under these conditions. Everybody just bust out. Orchestra's late, so that's a good line to use next time you come in early.
That's great.
I got one last one, and then it was my first year in the orchestra with Mazel, and I was first recording with Mazel, and he would always do things with no rehearsal. We did two or three pieces for my first tour, no rehearsal. We did a recording session, no rehearsal. Now, I've never played these pieces, so I had to go and listen to the recording, and it was a horn concerto. And the last movement, I went boom, and then the orchestra played the rim, then I hit a rim again. And so we're like 6 minutes into the session. Mazel goes, is everybody okay? Raise my hand. I said, he goes, yes, Mr. Adams. I said, yeah, the beginning of the fourth movement, I hit a rim. He said, okay. He said, anybody else? Yes, Mr. Adams. I said, yeah, I hit another rim here too, you know. And then he looks at me and goes, is there anything else, Mr. Adams? I'm like, nope, I'm good. And the whole orchestra started laughing, and even he laughed. but you know, some of the old guys were like, you know what? Lauren likes you. I said, why is it? I said, because you're not afraid. I'm like, no, man, if I'm messing up, you know. But they all say, that's a funny one, though. Man. I'm like, yeah, I hit another rim. Yeah, I was like, oh, no. Because I never, and there's a kick.
Douglas, were you going to mention something?
No, I'm just laughing, man. It's a beautiful story. Oh.
Let me throw one in, too. I was in a, I guess it was a student orchestra, whatever, and we were doing the Rite of Spring. I was playing bass drum and timpanist. Well, the story is the conductor stopped at the end of the rehearsal, said, great, all good. Anybody have anything? The timpanist raised his hand and said, yeah, you know, at 367, whatever. And the conductor looks at the score. My friend, you were fine. And the timpanist like, oh, no, it's not for me.
That's great.
I had to throw that in there.
Oh, he ratted you out, huh?
No, it wasn't for me either. It was for another section. It's like, oh, come on, man.
My mistake real quick.
Oh, okay. Here's Douglas' confession.
My mistake. You're okay? So I can't remember ever dropping a stick in like a you know, orchestra performance or concert band or something. Marching band, yeah, sure, you're doing stick flips and all that stuff. My senior recital, I forgot what I was even playing, but a timpani solo. Never dropped a stick, and it doesn't have a flip, but it caught the rim as I'm going from 23 to 32. One stick all the way across the stage. Oh. During the recital, never dropped it before. Total surprise, right? That's when you want to make the mistake in rehearsal or something, right? Or your dress.
Right.
Man, so I get three more bars about with one mallet, and I look over to I got it on video, right? I look over to the stagehand, and I'm going like, he brings it back to me, man, and I finish out the solo. But you know, you laugh at it because I mean, stuff happens, man.
Your ability to vamp and ad lib.
I can only get about three bars because some fat, other fast stuff was coming, man.
That's okay. That's okay. So, what I would ask you last is, you know, this is a good one. What would you tell your younger self?
I have two big ones. Just teaching a lot. A lot of us here still teach, even though we play. But I'm talking to my middle school students. And it's as though, I mean, I wish I had someone telling me this as I'm telling you, don't practice at a higher level than you are when you're playing too fast and you're making many mistakes. I mean, I always ask them, okay, you get to choose the tempo for this. Why did you choose that tempo? And I get them, I have a great rapport with them. So they're able to be honest and vulnerable. And the real answer usually for them is, what my answer usually is, I should be able to play it this fast. And the answer is, well, today you can't. I mean, obviously, but you're not. It's very simple. And then you get to a place to, can you play at a challenging level that you're challenging yourself, but you're not learning mistakes? So that ability to pick tempos that are not above us, but still challenging to us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great.
I mean, I did that tons in the practice room when I was young, so it's horrible. So,
yeah. Tim?
Mine is, I would tell my younger adult self, and that is understand that change in the world is slow and to be patient with it, because I lost patience. I lost patience because I was fighting for 28 years. And then one day I'm like, I'm done. I can't do it. And I don't regret the move. It was the right move, but that's what I would tell my younger self, you know, because I thought that with a certain amount of achievements, you would still be looked at a certain way. And it's true and not true. And I think it was very difficult for me to accept that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Is that clear?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Josh?
I would tell myself not to be ashamed of what I do or what I have to do. Like, if it takes me an hour to figure this out, it takes me an hour to figure it out. If I feel, I shouldn't feel ashamed of loving triangle as much as I do. I shouldn't feel weird about that. And also to be kind to myself and to not be ashamed to be seen is another one that I wish I told myself more when I was a kid.
Excellent. Michael?
I would tell my younger self to be more aware of the bigger picture. You know, for example, in piano class, I just did enough to get by. You know what I mean? I just got, you know, when the exam came along, I just did, you know, not realizing how important it was as a percussionist, you know, whereas I'm tending to think separately, you know, rather than realizing that, I mean, not just as a percussionist, but my whole development as a musician, you know. So I think there, for example, had I looked at had been more conscious of the bigger picture and worked just as hard at that as I did in my private percussion lessons, I would have been a much better musician and a much better percussionist overall, you know, in general. You know what I mean? Because whenever, like, for example, when Midea wanted me to do a concerto, you know, no problem. But I had to work, like, really hard at it. I think harder than I otherwise would have had I paid more attention to certain things when I was younger while I was studying. You know, my sight reading would have been better, you know, just in general. So I just think being more aware of the bigger picture is what I would tell my younger self, you know, and not be so compartmentalized and short-sighted, you know, in the approach to things, you know. So that's me in a nutshell. Yeah,
absolutely. For me, I don't have anything as deep and profound as you guys do, man. I just look back and say, man, just keep doing what you're doing. You're going to have an unbelievable experience. It's going to take you to places you never imagined. You never thought you'd be on stage with these amazing musicians, but just stay on track. You love it. You're always going to love it. So just spend time with it and just enjoy life. That's all.
I told Gladys Knight, I said, I can't believe I'm on the same stage with you. You know,
there you go.
Listening to you growing up as a kid.
There you go.
Here I am, you know, packing you up on stage. Yeah.
But anyway, guys, thank you so much. Let's keep this conversation about who we are, what we are, how we got there, how we can help others, because it's inspiring to all of us. And that's what we're here for. Thank you, folks.
Thanks, guys.
See you next time.
Bye, guys.
All right.
Take care now.
That concludes this episode with our ABOP founders, Tim Adams, Douglas Cardwell, Michael Crusoe, Josh Jones, Johnny Lee Lane, and me, your host, Raynor Carroll. Thank you, founders. Our mentorship program is off to a great start with our proteges. If you missed the first Founders Roundtable discussion, it is episode number 3 in the ABOP podcast series. Please check it out. ABOP is a nonprofit. Your donations are tax deductible. For different ways to contribute, check out our website, www.abop.us. Please follow our podcast. We greatly appreciate your support. We are the Alliance of Black Orchestral Percussionists, ABOP. Thank you for listening.